You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the season of the Orthodox Nativity. And for those in the old calendar, I wish you a very fruitful Nativity season. But other parts of the world, it's a very different story. There's nothing fruitful about what's going on in Syria. And the more you learn about the topic, the more you realize that the complete demolition of the country, it's not just the state, but the demolition of the country is far more important to the regime, especially to the Zionists. Syria collapsed as a nation because the livelihood, the finances, the careers of its population, this was all destroyed. It's due to the American occupation, the regime's occupation of her energy resources, the deliberate burning of grain fields and stores, grain stores, sanctions, of course, that's designed to terrorize the population. And just as importantly, the constant Israeli attacks over the last few years, destroying the military readiness and institutions of the once very strong Syrian Arab Army. By the time Assad picked up and left, Damascus could maybe produce an hour of electricity a day, which means that things like water and sewage couldn't function. Much of the economy couldn't function. A soldier's monthly salary was less than $10. And even high-ranking officers, 30 and 40, way below subsistence. Yes, they tried to pursue Chinese investments in manufacturing, but the constant terror attacks made this a problem. Even in their attempts to approach the Gulf monarchies, which was successful for a time, but that too was prevented by the Americans, lest the economy recover. At one time, the Syrian economy was very strong, very vibrant. It was collapsed, but it was done deliberately. You can't field an army under those conditions. So when the terrorists, in the pay of the Americans, started their final offensive against this very weakened state, Assad decided for the sake of peace that it was best for him to leave. And he was very serious because he rejected Russian and Iranian military assistance because that really wouldn't do anything. That would bring more death and destruction in Syria. The suffering of the population would not be improved. And he was aware that the regime would never stop. Regardless of anything he did, the war against him would stop no differently than it occurred in Libya or Iraq. Now, of course, that kind of economic situation naturally is going to lead to corruption. Corruption in a sense, because bureaucrats were forced to do what they had to earn a living. When you read the controlled Western press that condemned Syria for corruption, I think they were just dimly aware that the regime created these conditions in the first place. Assad, as I've said before, taking it directly from his father, courageous, very strong, honorable man, virtuous man, who cared about the Syrian nation more than himself, more than even his family. As I've said a few times before, recently, whether it be in Ukraine or the Middle East, the regime, now led by the U.S., has now actively used and promoted blatant terrorist tactics against its opponents. And thanks to the controlled media, it's now been normalized. I was reading an older essay by Michael Hoffman, and he cited someone who you should be familiar with, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who said that blocking humanitarian aid to Gaza is justified and moral, even if it causes millions of civilians to die of hunger. He actually said that, well, we would do this, but the international community won't allow it to happen. Here's what he said. We bring in aid to Gaza because there's no other choice. We can't, in the current global reality, manage a war. No one will let us, because 2 million civilians to die of hunger, even though it might be justified and moral, until our hostages are returned. Humanitarianism, in exchange for humanitarianism, is morally justified. But what can we do? We live today in a certain reality, and we need international legitimacy for this war. Now, it's bad enough that this man thinks that Jews are somehow oppressed because they can't starve millions to death. But worse than that, he says that Israel somehow is held captive by international legitimacy, like that's some object that you have to possess. Starvation and terror are normal aspects of Zionist occupation policy, and it has been since 1948, and Israel always gets away with it. They are international legitimacy. I've written on Syria many times over the years, starting in my paper in college, 33 years ago, on Hafez al-Assad and the development of the Syrian military under his command. He was a general, of course, unlike his son. The downfall of Assad is the downfall of Syria, but there was so much potential. I've been writing on Syria for a long time, and I've spoke very optimistically about the economic picture. But that's exactly the regime's problem. A strong economy in Syria is intolerable to Israel. ISIS has taken over in certain areas, a group entirely made with American and Israeli money. That flag was raised in Damascus. And of course, this is going to have spillover effects all over the place, because the regime is trying to isolate Iran. But of course, the ultimate goal is Russia and China. We're in the Orthodox Nativity season. It's easy to forget that between 15 and 20% of the Syrian population was Orthodox. Many Greeks, mostly urban, were the backbone of its formerly prosperous cities. And they backed, almost to a man, the Baathist state. The regime didn't try to destroy Syria, it would be a first world economy by now. Again, that's the problem. A large military doesn't mean much if you don't have the economic foundation to back it up. What's far more threatening is that very first world economic foundation. So Syria had to be plunged into mass murder, terror, poverty, uncertainty, for the sake of democracy, of course. They never even tried to understand the nature of the Baathist state. But they pretended, of course, as always, relying on public ignorance. The regime has waged a relentless war of attrition and extinction, which is very important. It's not just against the government, but the people as such. Syria had to be destroyed, not just the state. I wrote... It was back in 2021 about the elections, two elections that brought Assad at least electoral legitimacy very handily. In 2014 and 2021. In 2021, Assad won by at a margin, 95.1% in a three-man race. It was a legitimate election. Not all of the country was under his control, unfortunately. But it was overseen by election observers from Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador, Armenia, and a few other places. And even after he was elected both times, huge pro-Assad rallies broke out in most major cities. It was only in the areas that were controlled by the American Islamic militias, and sometimes punishable by death. Voting was out of the question, and only in Western states was the Syrian diaspora forbidden to vote. My article back then on the election, said the press release from the White House was dated several days, if not weeks, prior to the election. So they had condemned the election before it happened. And I'm not sure how they can condemn something when they weren't there to see it. Well, I'm going to quote myself here. In 2015, I wrote something called Russia and the Victory in Syria. And here's what I said. In 2011, demonstrations against Assad grew in size around the capital and outlying cities. Vague demands of democratization were reported by foreign media as the cause. At the same time, the Syrian economy was markedly improving, and Assad had just unveiled a set of reforms to modernize both the energy and financial sectors. Despite a global recession, Syria was averaging GDP growth of 5-6% a year, at least according to the World Bank. Given that, the timing of these quote-unquote spontaneous demonstrations is very strange. The other timing issue is the fact that these spontaneous rebellions occurred almost to the day that the paperwork was signed for the new Iran-Syria pipeline. The pipeline would benefit that military alliance between Iran and Syria and bypass Europe's own infrastructure. Nabucco was called, at the time not completed, and far smaller than what was proposed in 2011. That would have been a massive program, bringing wealth to the area and creating a very strong financial foundation for the military alliance of Iran and Syria to continue. It would bypass Turkey and knit together Iran, Russia, Iraq, and Syria. Now, when I wrote that 10 years ago, Russia and the Syrian army were at their highest point. They had defeated the Mossad-ISIS combine handily and exposed the fact that the U.S. was backing ISIS and al-Qaeda there. But since then, everything has changed. Financial pressure from the West, the constant attacks from the IDF. Syria became a shadow of its former self. It couldn't defend its own borders. But the objective from the start was to harass Syrians, to render them helpless, to render them broken, so that they can be obedient to the New World Order, as I said back then, today, the Great Reset. Having no foundation to rebel against the economic colonization of the country by BlackRock. Everything has changed in 2025. You don't need to be a PhD in political philosophy or history to know that these mercenaries, these so-called jihadist groups, are going to start slaughtering people. Reports all over the place about these awful war crimes against civilians. Anyone connected even indirectly to Assad. A few people have mentioned Metropolitan Ephraim of Aleppo, the first big city captured by the American-backed terrorists. As far as I know, has gone missing and is certainly a captive of the American-backed militias. The HTS, the leader's criminal background, of course, expecting him to come to power, that was scrubbed and then normalized by CNN. That specific group has publicly announced its intention to cut off the Metropolitan's beard and ears and behead him. And that's nothing would please the Americans more. That's not an idle matter because in 2013, his predecessor, Metropolitan Paul Yazighi, along with the Monophysite Syriac Orthodox Archbishop of Johanna, of Aleppo, Johanna, Ibrahim, they were kidnapped and disappeared. I can't imagine the cynicism. U.S. State Department has something called a Rewards for Justice program. They offered a few million dollars for information on the ISIS network responsible for kidnapping this group of people. A whole bunch of clerics were kidnapped. No Islamic group had ever done that in the past. They had gotten along with Muslims for a very long time. Only ISIS started attacking these people. Of course, no money was ever paid. Thousands right now are being displaced. There's road closures everywhere, refugee camps swelling. The Christians, Orthodox or no, members of other minority groups are trapped in their homes. But it just follows the pattern of events in Libya and Iraq and even Sudan. David Curry, who was the president of Global Christian Relief, who has many contacts inside Syria, said that at least in the northern part of the country, Turkish-backed terrorists continue to fight for territory and perpetrate heinous acts of violence against Kurdish and Yazidi religious communities. ISIS, of course, is going to do what they're told. Scientists, religious leaders, former army officials, anyone accused of having any connection to the military is murdered in the worst possible way. And now that they don't have a common enemy anymore, they're starting to fight each other. And the regime really can't tell one from another. Turkish-backed terrorists openly kill Kurds in hospitals. Syria's north and northeast, at least, mired in total anarchy. And that, of course, according to plan. Whether it be Iraq, Libya, and Sudan, the regime destroys any rational, legitimate government so the lowest elements of the population can take over and begin cleansing the country. The prisons have all been emptied. Of course, its cells are now full of members of the legitimate government. This is very different from the Taliban in Afghanistan because that is a local and popular movement. ISIS, of course, was sent to attack them. Syrian rebels are just mercenaries using Islam to shut down any kind of dissent. These men can't govern anything. They're just a goon squad. The regime now, being broke, only works through mercenaries. There's an execrable group, the Syrian Emergency Task Force. Here's what they said when Assad fled. They said, mission accomplished. The Syrian Emergency Task Force is proud to announce that the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran have been officially defeated in Syria by the Syrian people on their own and without any outside support from the international community. See, I can't get inside the head of someone who would write something like that. Of course, what they really promoted was an Al-Qaeda and ISIS or Daesh terrorist takeover directed by Western intelligence. Either they know that they're lying or that they are so alienated from reality, living in their sanitized and censored world, they don't realize the blatant contradiction of saying that the Syrian people had no help from the international community, but what were they doing? They undercut their own purpose. That group is funded by USAID, essentially a CIA front. It's thus an official agency. And essentially what they say is that they are bringing an end to the atrocities against Syrian civilians, mostly by permitting many atrocities against Syrian civilians. It's a Zionist front. They've advocated every conceivable way to cripple the society, inventing all kinds of fake media stories, being from Israel, trying to manipulate and alter the opinion of, and especially now, a very suggestible population. They are at least partly responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands sacrificed for Zionism in Syria. Now, the director is named Muaz Mustafa, who I think 24 hours after Assad left, met with Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, talking about all of this. Someone like Max Blumenthal, however, said the following. Check out the SCTF's $153,535 grant from USAID, a CIA cutout. It not only earmarks the delivery of aid to Rukaban camp, but also covers conducting key informant interviews. SETF has been at the forefront of lobbying for the U.S. to wage war on Syria, even taking John McCain on his notorious trip in 2013 before he called to bomb Damascus. It played a seminal role in the Caesar Act sanctions, which have plunged Syrian civilians into poverty and remain at the center of all regime change activities. Poverty is the goal. Now, that was written in response to a professional airhead named Salim Kassim, very young, very tech-savvy SETF employee, nothing but a propagandist, completely ignorant of Syrian politics, a young, vaguely attractive girl. David Miller, who the producer of the Press TV show, I think it's Palestine Declassified, spoke about them, and her in particular. He said, SETF's board includes a member from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an organization that acts as a direct foreign agent of the Zionist entity in the U.S. After I won my tribunal, Celine attempted to sabotage my legal fundraiser by inciting British Sunnis into sectarian hysteria over the failed NATO and Zionist regime change campaign in Syria. Of course, he's referring to Celine Qassem, Well, the point, of course, is to undermine any resistance to Zionism, which is the main driver of American foreign policy. It was March of last year they celebrated the 13th anniversary of the Syrian Revolution, is what they call it. Of course, at a Republican gathering. I strongly doubt that Ms. Kasim knows any of this or understands any of this. But she's the type of young girl who likes the fashionable and sacrifice-less cause to fight for. If it's trendy, she's going to do it. That seems to be the case here. Max Blumenthal wrote a book called The Management of Savagery. And he says that this group emerged as just a lobbying group funded by the State Department, of course, collection of wealthy private donors, typical for foreign policy under oligarchy. And this was the direct link between the Congress and the Free Syrian Army. And Mustafa's interesting because he can't stop advocating military attacks and sanctions and killings of his own country, which, of course, he has a tangential relationship to. He, of course, worked in the Libyan case, the Libyan National Transitional Council, prior to the invasion by the Gulf monarchies, the U.S. and France. So now in two cases, this man is partly responsible for plunging the Arab, an Arab country into chaos, dire poverty, constant warfare, terror, uncertainty, and starvation at the behest of a small group of Jews. This is a guy, in 2013, who went to John McCain, persuaded him to visit Syria, and of course he was there with Al-Qaeda. The guy who coordinated this, a Jew named Mordecai Kahana, multimillionaire, he coordinated these efforts, and of course is one of the people who finances these militants via the Israeli military, and he has an NGO called Amalia. And he talks about, you know, he openly boasts about financing all of this. Bringing John McCain over there was a coup for them. So this was the man who linked up American officials, useful idiots like him, with terror cells in Syria. McCain's stupid book, The Restless Wave, he mentions this. You've all seen that famous picture of McCain by Mustafa, two armed terrorists, almost as if to prove to the world what he was. But Lebanese media, just a couple of days later, identified these two men. It was Abu Ibrahim and Muhammad Noor, who were part of the kidnapping of 11 Shiite pilgrims just a year earlier, which, of course, for McCain is not a problem whatsoever. Mustafa, through Jews like Kahana, are this is the mechanism by which these terror groups were financed. Mustafa, that same year, arranged a meeting in Syria, one rebel group at least, and Evan McMullen, a CIA officer, one of the first things he did was to protest the designation of Al-Qaeda as a terrorist group, which, as far as I'm concerned, is enough to, you know, these people had nothing to do with 9/11. They wouldn't be allied with them if that was the case. Now, I haven't seen the documentary called Red Line. It was supposed to, you know, demonstrate how wonderful the rebels were. But that documentary revealed a complete network of corruption and crime. There would be no rebel movement in Syria without the United States. The whole war was stage managed by the West. It had no reason to exist prior to that. Mustafa had frequent trips from Washington to the Syria-Turkey border, and he's helping smuggle terrorists into areas near Homs, the city, talking about very expensive heavy weapons shipments. They don't mention the American manufacturer, but some of this, by the way, came from the Ukrainian military, after it lost its 2014 war against the Donbass republics. Mustafa is in this documentary. You could see prisoners in some school basement looting a cement factory. All kinds of terrorists rejecting, you know, any, you know, desire for democracy. Mustafa and the head of the White Helmet and the clueless Congressman Elliot Engel, probably the, well, possibly one of the most fanatical supporters of Israel on Capitol Hill, lobbied for even more sanctions on Syria, including sanctions on countries that traded with Damascus. I think it's interesting to note that those sanctions targeted the country's state-run central banking system, and of course that's going to be handed over to BlackRock. But it did things like blocking the shipment of replacement parts for civilian airliners, which, no doubt in my mind, is an act of terror. The only reason you would do that is to bring down civilian airliners. A while ago, I wrote something on the stupid white helmets. But there are groups like the Hand in Hand for Syria. Can you imagine how cringy that is to name your group that? The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which I have to admit I've only heard of the other day. But they all receive tremendous amounts of money from corporate America and, of course, governments. They're all considered trustworthy and reliable sources by Western journalists, despite their direct ties to terrorism, the Israeli regime, Western intelligence, but that's all quite normal. It's all reporters use these sources without fail or exception. The fact that elite elements finance these groups, of course, with government backing, that's sufficient for journalists and the public to see them as reliable sources. That's what it comes down to. Let me quote again something I wrote on the White Helmet fraud back in 2019. The helmets are clearly aligned with the American-backed rebel groups in Syria, since they operate solely in areas controlled by militants fighting against the government. They have financial, ideological, and personal connections with terrorist organizations and their Western sponsors. The white helmets are purely a media creation. Their rescue efforts only seem to occur when cameras are around. There's already a real civil defense group that works tirelessly in Syria. They don't need Western assistance. The white helmets are not first responders. They don't have any training in that area. It's just part of the information warfare mentality of the regime. White helmets were founded by a former British Army officer, again funded by British and American governments. And the only thing it really did was produce a stream of images, videos, and reports for their wonderful life-saving work. And in order for this to work, they needed a elite British-funded, in fact, state-funded PR company, ARK, to control the social media accounts and controlled entirely how this group was to be presented to the world. A highly successful campaign. Of course, none of it was real. They're not a civil defense. They're not first responders. The whole thing was phony, a typical mirage in the postmodern world. Same thing goes for the Hand in Hand for Syria. They've changed their name, Hand in Hand for Aid and Development, so they kept the Hand in Hand thing. They're in Syria and Turkey. They claim to be engaged in humanitarian work, but the only thing they seem to do is campaign for foreign military intervention in Syria. Fadi Sahul, I don't know if that's a male or a female, but declared openly that he wanted to topple Assad, quote, no matter what lives it takes, no matter how much catastrophe it causes. It turns out it's a one-man operation, based in Britain and is funded by the British Foreign Office. The mouthpiece for MI6. So this is all the same network. Social media, technology-savvy employees like Ms. Kassim, they're part of this illusion creation, because apparently TikTok influencers are now deemed competent to pronounce on complex international events and even lobby governments. But it's important to lay out this web of deceit. This is how the regime operates. It's a partnership of many elements, powerful elements coming together to control a narrative and to funnel money. It's based on the creation of creating and funding numerous front groups, as I mentioned, that pretend to be objective, pretend to be something that they're not, and they feed misinformation to the media. Again, this is a typical pattern. And then from there, academics and pretend public intellectuals, of course, taking these groups at face value, they develop theories using these false facts that then further solidify that misinformation into doctrine, settled fact. And of course, there's always informal sanctions against dissenters. So in the meantime, censorship ensures that these acolytes will never have to deal with serious scholarship. They'll never have to deal with serious criticism. That means they are in a world of their own making that leads to an entirely mythical conception of the world based on lies, gaslighting, manipulation, projection, and emotion. But let me be clear about something. I was the first writer. You remember when ISIS just out of nowhere exploded on the front page? I was the first one to make the argument that this was a American-Israeli operation. Nothing about it made any sense. Out of nowhere. They had their own fleet of tankers. They had their own currency. They had a regular army. They weren't a guerrilla group. The stupid pictures and videos that, it turns out, were created by Rita Katz and that whole, it was a Mossad group. And there was some help from Pakistan's inter-services intelligence and Saudi Arabia's general intelligence presidency. They were, and not only were they suddenly in the headlines, fighting a very strong Syrian army to a standstill. They never ran out of ammunition. They never ran out of supplies. Do you remember they were accused of the most lurid and cartoonish crimes that all of a sudden are no longer being committed? They would attack Monophysite and Orthodox monasteries who had been there for 1,500 years, never attacking the U.S., never attacking Israel, or Saudi Arabia for that matter. When the war erupted with Gaza and Israel, I don't recall anyone from ISIS even saying anything in their favor. And the criminals who've taken over in Syria openly are Zionists, or at a minimum say that we love Jews, we're not going to have anything to do with them. But NATO and the Turkish army were responsible initially for the recruitment of ISIS and al-Nusra mercenaries. Right at the very start of the war, Israeli intelligence says that that initiative was a, quote, campaign to enlist thousands of Muslim volunteers in Middle East countries and Muslim world to fight alongside Syrian rebels. The Turkish army would house these volunteers, train them, and secure their passage into Syria. That was from an article called NATO to Give Rebels Anti-Tank Weapons, August of 2011. There's always been special forces from NATO and intelligence operatives within the ranks of ISIL-ISIS. They've been training these people, especially British SAS, training them in Syria and elsewhere. Western military specialists contracted out to the Pentagon. And even CNN admitted that they trained these rebels in the use of chemical weapons. So they projected that into that ridiculous chemical weapons attack that Assad allegedly engaged in. None of that, nothing made any sense, but public ignorance being what it is, they don't know if it's true or not. But CNN, December 9th, 2012, said the U.S. and some European allies are using defense contractors to train Syrian rebels on how to secure chemical weapons stockpiles in Syria, or so a senior U.S. official and several senior diplomats told CNN. Only chemical weapons were brought in by the West. Many of these mercenaries were convicted criminals. Saudi Arabia opened its prisons on the condition that they join the group. In fact, death row was emptied. These men were recruited to join these brigades with full Israeli support. In that case, out of the Golan Heights, these fighters have met Israeli IDF, even Netanyahu personally. The U.S. is not at war with any of these groups. The U.S. never attacked any of them. But the clueless media, as always, repeat what they're told. The Turkish president, who is just a big disappointment. You know, all of a sudden, the Gaza war is off the front page. The mass slaughter is off the front page. And Erdogan says that a bright period for Syria has begun. All they're doing, of course, is feeding off the carcass of what was once a very powerful economy. After 350 IDF strikes, the entire infrastructure of the Syrian Arab Army was destroyed. Weapons factories, munitions, bases, jets, even Russian anti-ship systems, even the ships, air defense positions, and not a single word of protest from the Arab world. And in that context, Israel began its colonization of Syrian territory, the Golan Heights, of course, using Al-Qaeda and ISIS to do this. Turkish Air Force has always been at you know, now it's like at 30% capacity because of the coup, massive purges of high-ranking officers. I suppose it's settled now, but they lost all of their talent. But the pretext, of course, was to keep weapons from falling into the hands of the Kurds. Now, the Russians really weren't hurt by all of this. But Turkish intervention has been nothing but a problem from the beginning. As far as I know, these Jewish terrorists in the IDF are very close to Damascus itself. I mean, they've always been there in one capacity or another, but now we're talking about military force. Southern Lebanon is now exposed to attack, and of course, so is Iran. Syria's coastal regions especially, its major cities are being destroyed. The economy is reduced to nothing. Mass persecutions. Alawites to the grave and Christians to Beirut was the slogan. I think it's very generous. The Alawites are being hunted down and beheaded. But this was known in advance. I mean, Mossad is more than aware of the agenda of these groups that it created in the first place. The promise to exterminate the Alawites, that was the initial slogan of the rebel movement. But they didn't stop there. Once they took over the Idlib area, they did the same thing to the Druze villagers. It never ends. Alawites are hunted down like dogs, quite literally, as a few people have noted. Since when they're kidnapped, they have to bark like dogs and drink the urine of their captors. And that's true because of how dogs are perceived in most Islamic sects as a dirty, untrustworthy element. The Orthodox people possibly have escaped to Beirut. And the Shiites also be hunted down. They're a fairly small minority. But in this acid trip, hallucination of illogic, the U.S. just blames Iran for everything. This is beyond projection. It's beyond propaganda. But the official claim today is that the destruction that the U.S. has brought to Syria is now the fault of the Iranians. James Jeffrey, I think I've cited him before. He was the U.S. ambassador to both Iraq and Turkey. He laid out the template, something I've been saying, of course, for a very long time. But let me quote him. Syria, given its size, its strategic location, its historical importance, is the pivot point for whether there can be an American-managed security system in the region. And so you've got this general alliance that's locked in with us, but the stress point is greatest in Syria. He also said in 2021, he's talking about the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the HTS. We got Mike Pompeo to issue a waiver to allow us to give aid to HTS. I received and sent messages to HTS. He said that they were just writing back to him, we're your friends, we're not terrorists, we're just fighting Assad. Let me quote him even more directly on this topic. It was important to us that HTS not disintegrate. Our policy was to leave HTS alone. And the fact that we haven't targeted them ever, the fact that we have never raised our voice to the Turks about their cohabitation with them. In fact, I used this example the last time I was talking to a very senior Turkish official. When they started bitching about this relationship we have with the SDF in eastern Syria, I said, look, Turkey has always maintained that you want us in northeast Syria, which they do, but you don't understand. We can't be in northeast Syria without the platform because we only have a few hundred troops there. I said, it's just like you in Idlib. We want you to be there, but you can't be there without having a platform, and that platform is largely HTS. HTS is a UN-designated official terrorist organization. And he's talking to the Turks, and he says, have I ever, or any American ever, complained to you Turks about what you're doing there with HTS? Yeah, it's a lot of word salad, but we really know what he's saying. Of course, this is Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Nusra. The boundaries are not hard and fast. They're mercenaries from all over the world. Very few of them are actually Syrians. They talk about ISIS putting on suits. I think it was Dr. Ayman Zawahiri. They explicitly were told, HTS and other groups, that were never to target Israel or the West under any circumstances. Many of the anti-Assad Sunni Muslims are unconvinced by the HTS, you know, conversion to Western liberalism. David Miller is a British academic, and he talks about the situation. He says, while ISIS put on suits, allowed Syria to be carved up by the U.S., preached peace with the Zionist state, want free markets, cut gas deals with their regional patrons, their true believers in the Sunni identitarian diaspora, haven't yet clocked that they've been sold out, as was always the plan. In private, the planners for this war in NATO, they laugh about sending young Salafi cannon fodder from around the world into the meat grinder. That $2,000 salaries that are a mere speck of sand compared to the gas and construction wealth that's expected to be returned to Turkish, Qatari, Israeli, and American coffers. They killed Palestine for this, and they'll spend the next 30 years justifying it based on whatever line the very expensive PR firms hired by the NATO and Gulf states shill to them. The Syrian regime change operation is a rug pull of the century. Well, of course, he's talking about the fact that these people don't matter. They're there as goons. They're there as enforcement only. Of course, what it's led to is mass starvation and mass death. By the 2010s, the alleged war against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and elsewhere, of course, they were working together for the sake of overthrowing Assad, and they don't care what they had to do. CIA was spending $1 billion a year training and arming a network of these groups. Jake Sullivan, in a leaked 2012 email, Jake Sullivan told Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, said that Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. Unless one acts as a true scholar, very few, a true scholar peels back the layers of deceit and illusion until the truth is revealed or unveiled. Without that, the only thing that would be known are these shadows, illusions of major media. Even the Turkish press admits all of this stuff. The ambassador and deputy undersecretary in charge of the Middle East and Asia, the Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, admits it. Talking about the war on Assad and his overthrow, there's no one involved in Syria that wasn't trained or financed by these people. They're not Syrians. It goes back even to Dick Cheney's time. After Israel's unsuccessful war on Hezbollah in 2006, you know, of course, you know, Cheney being an idiot, he didn't understand how this could happen. And how is it Iran that is the primary benefactor of the war in Iraq from 1990 to 2006? And he spoke with the then Saudi intelligence chief, he's dead now, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who said, you know what, Iran could be neutralized through a war on Syria. And that became Operation Timber Sycamore. He also said that U.S. direct involvement will be unnecessary, which became more of a necessity as time went on, and that Bandar himself would orchestrate the project. And he claimed, speaking for the king, he says, the king knows that other than the collapse of the Islamic Republic itself, nothing would weaken Iran more than losing Syria. Now, people like Jeffrey are talking about the rug pull, as I mentioned, a trick on Syria by the Gulf states. Groups like the HTS, this was a rebranded and well-armed amalgam of various militias, mercenaries, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS, directed by Turkish and American intelligence, financed by Qatar, among other places. The U.S. justifies its troops there because they're protecting people from the threat of ISIS. It's, of course, Washington created and installed in the first place. That was the threat that justified the occupation in the northeast of Syria. Israeli attacks could be justified by any one of these Islamic groups doing something stupid. It could always be presented as defensive measures against jihadists. And really, it's only the Western media that could believe this bizarre set of lies, and even worse, calling them established facts. The last few years, Syria's military really was never a threat to Israel. And I'm going to end with a quote from John Mearsheimer, who says the following. Israel's goal here is basically to wreck Syria. It's not in large part because of Israel, by the way. I think that Americans and the Turks played a much more prominent role than Israel did in wrecking Syria. Yeah. The country is wrecked, and I don't know anybody who thinks that the rebels who are now in control in Damascus are going to be able to restore order in the country. From Israel's point of view, this is a perfectly fine situation. Well, he's dead wrong on the Israeli part of it. They're the main beneficiary. The U.S. doesn't benefit. No one benefits, really, except the Israelis. Terrorism is now the preferred instrument for spreading democracy. I mean, wrecking Syria is just another term for plunging millions into poverty and uncertainty. Something like the existence imposed on the Palestinians in Gaza for decades, just perpetually on the brink of starvation. This is the normal Talmudic order of things. Non-Jews are an inferior species. Of course, this is aimed at Iran. Now, of course, I said all this a decade ago. The West created and sustained these terror groups, ISIS especially. I was dismissed, but now it's admitted by the regime itself. Yeah, the U.S. doesn't need oil from this area. It does need to use energy assets to collateralize its massive debt. Europe, of course, has collapsed, now deindustrialized. They're no longer even major powers. And in response, the regime will simply permit more military-aid migrants into the EU to serve as a reserve army against those whites that might take exception to being replaced. And of course, that's why censorship exists. This is an evil that many people haven't seen before. And it's evil in that respect because it's being presented as something completely different. Media is an evil tool of Antichrist, as are these Talmudists, as are these Zionists, and as is the American, at least the American-led regime in BlackRock. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.